Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this extra episode, the name Bill Ayers rings a bell for people of a certain age. He is one of the icons of 60s and 70s countercultural and anti-Vietnam War movements. As a young man, he became a founder of the notorious leftist radical organization, the Weather Underground. One of the group's goals was to overthrow the U.S. government. They orchestrated a string of bombings of public offices. In 1970, three members were killed when a bomb they were building exploded. Ayers became a fugitive for a time after that incident. The Ayers legacy rang a bell again in 2008 when Republicans linked him to presidential candidate Barack Obama in an effort to associate Obama with radical ideals. Subsequent investigations showed the two did not have close ties. Ayers has a long career as a teacher. He is known for his work as an education reformer. He recently retired from his position as a distinguished professor of education at the University of Illinois. Bill Ayers is the author of many books, including Fugitive Days, a memoir, Teaching Toward Freedom, Moral Commitment, and Ethical Action in the Classroom, Public Enemy, Confessions of an American Dissident, and Demand the Impossible, a Radical Manifesto. He spoke at Impact Hub Seattle in Pioneer Square on November 1st, in a conversation hosted by Northeastern University Seattle. If you are genuinely curious about what a 60s radical may be thinking about and talking about in the age of Trump, his talk will inform and possibly surprise you.
My name is Peter Tennis. I am the Dean and Campus Chief Executive of Northeastern in Seattle. We're up in South Lake Union. I've known Bill Ayers for almost 20 years now. And for all the things you might know or wonder about Bill, I think the most salient characteristic is he's a man with a very big heart. He's someone who cares about people very, very much. As you know, he was an actual American revolutionary, and may still be.
It was?
Yeah, all right.
I haven't turned in my card yet.
Yeah, I see you got that little star there on your little column. Bill is a phenomenal writer, and we've got three of his books here. You can buy a copy on your way out if you'd like. Each one of these is a terrific book. We've got Demand the Impossible, Public Enemy, which is his second memoir, and this really terrific book to teach the journey in comics. You know, Bill is known as a political leader, as a leader on the radical left. Bill's great contribution, in my opinion, is as such an exemplary teacher, as someone who, for thousands of future teachers, really modeled and led the way for them to be able to listen to young people and show them the kind of respect that precludes a lot of the bad things that he fights against outside his life as an educator. So with that, I just would like to ask you to give a hand for our friend Bill Ayers, and then we'll begin the show.
Thank you so much, Peter, and thank you for inviting me, and thank you for being here. I get a little embarrassed with the generous introduction, and I'm reminded my son Malik, who's now 38 years old, but he heard me give a talk to teachers when he was 5 years old, and afterwards he said he thought I did pretty well, but that I went on too long, and then he asked the question, the professors get paid by the word, and I thought, gosh, how does he know that? He's only five, and we do. So I take note of the fact that this is a community conversation, and this is not the best setting for a conversation because there's a stage and because you're sitting there, but let's make it a conversation. I'll talk for a bit, but I would really very much prefer to have some back and forth, and all of it in the spirit of trying to name this political moment, trying to name the moment we're living in and cringing before, and trying to figure out what do we do next, what is to be done, which I think is, and is there hope? I think it's something that everywhere I go in the last 6 months, people are troubled and people are searching for what's next. I think we should do some of that searching tonight, and we should do it together. I'm sorry that my partner of 47 years, Bernadine Dorn, is not with me, but she's at home. We both, can I tell you an intimate detail? This is elder intimacy. We've been together 47 years. We each had a hip replaced 3 weeks ago by the same doctor on the same day. Can you imagine? We gave the staff such a kick because they thought, God, old people, this is one way that you really get close, you know, new hips. But that's why I'm kind of limping around up here, but I'm actually doing great, so is she. Bernadine is a special person, and as I say, we've been together for a long time. I'm still hoping it will work out. But she, I'll tell you a funny story. We get harassed a lot online, and we get death threats and all that, and we have for a long, long time, so we're quite, you know, inured to it. But last summer, we got a packet of materials in the mail sent to our home address, and one thing was that it was all right-wing kitsch. One was a t-shirt with a picture of Welch's grape juice on one side and a picture of me on the other side. And under this it said good free radical, and here it said bad free radical, which I thought was pretty wonderful. And then there was a bumper sticker in there, and it said, and I showed it to Bernadine, and it said, Bill Ayers and his wife should be in prison. And I showed it to Bernadine, and she said, his wife? Not a word about prison. I thought that was very telling. Don't call me his wife if you're going to put me in prison. In any case, let me start with the business of trying to say where we are. And I guess I'm going to take off a little bit from one of the books that Peter held up, which is called The Man, the Impossible. And that came out last year with Haymarket Press. And it's something I thought about for a long time. But I finally sat down and wrote it. And it's a very, very brief book. And it's the subtitle is A Radical Manifesto. And the motivation for writing it was that I think people like us, people I tend to hang out with, people who try to have their eyes open, people who try to stay woke, as they say, are pretty good at criticizing what is. We pretty much know what we don't like. We're pretty good at critiquing the social system and the economic system and the political system. But the question is, what are we fighting for? What do we want? And if you don't know what you want, then it's kind of derails you in the here and now. I mean, you have to have a vision somewhere of what you're trying to achieve. And I was, part of the motivation was thinking back 30 years ago when we hosted in our living room a conversation between Albie Sachs, the great South African revolutionary who became the Chief Justice of the Constitutional Court of South Africa, in conversation with Rashid Khalidi, the Palestinian scholar and activist. And they were, again, as we often are, trying to name the political moment, in that case for South Africa and for the Palestinian struggle. And Albie said, you know, at the height of the war against apartheid, we were criticized because we would take 2-3 days off every month and go on a retreat, a workshop, a political meeting, where we would try to say, what is it we're fighting for? And we tried to do it every month, and we tried to do it because the way we were fighting, the tactics we used, the strategies we pursued, would all be derailed if we didn't have a good idea of what we wanted. So to kind of name and define what we want matters, because it kind of guides us in the here and now, as well as, you know, gives us kind of a sustenance toward what we're trying to reach. I've often in my life been called a romantic and a utopian, and there's truth to it. I'm not an innocent romantic. And my mother was a wonderful, innocent Pollyanna. I remember when I was taking care of her about 30 years ago, she'd broken her ankle, and she's since passed away, but I was taking care of her, and she asked me kind of innocently, what's this thing I've heard called global warming? And I gave her a very simple, easy, painless response, because I didn't want to scare the shit out of her. And she looked at me very coolly, and she said, well, I'm sorry I asked. Exactly. Because if you ask, you might get an answer. And if you get an answer, you might feel you have to do something. As long as her lawn was green, as long as her swimming pool was filled, why should she worry about global warming? Well, that's kind of the you know, a kind of standard response of privilege. You have to kind of open your eyes. And the rhythm, to me, of activism is the same as the rhythm of good citizenship or being a moral person. You have to open your eyes. You have to pay attention, and not once, but every day, all the time. And that can be a very excruciating and painful thing. Just one example from this week. I've often said that no president should be able to bomb a country he can't find on a map, and that would lower the level of violence incredibly. So do you really think that Donald Trump, or maybe even many of us, could find Niger on a map, or could find Mali on a map? Or even could, I ask my students, could you draw a freehand sketch of Iraq? We've only been fighting there for, 13 years or something. Could you draw a freehand sketch with the major cities and the surrounding countries? Well, we don't, and we don't know how to do that because, you know, privilege allows us to, you know, not pay attention in those ways. Paying attention means, for example, noticing that we have troops all over Africa suddenly, and that we weren't aware of it. That's what opening our eyes means. So the rhythm of activism always involves paying attention, opening your eyes, and being astonished at both the beauty and the ecstasy that people are capable of, and also being astonished at the unnecessary suffering that we visit upon one another. It's if you get used to the unnecessary suffering, then you're in trouble. You should be astonished each time you look out this window and see a gathering of homeless Americans. You should be astonished, and I want to be astonished. The first time I saw a homeless child in New York, I wanted to jump off a bridge, and after a couple of years, I saw homeless kids in New York. You know, it becomes the commonplace. We can't allow ourselves to become, you know, softened and just kind of take for granted the unacceptable. So, to me, the rhythm of activism, first we have to open our eyes, pay attention, then we have to be astonished, then we have to act, we have to do something, and then we have to doubt. We have to rethink, and then we repeat. For me, when I look back on my activism and the various things I've been involved in, it's really the failure to do that fourth step that characterizes the mistakes, for example, of the Weather Underground and of SBS at a certain point. The failure to say, we don't know everything, let's rethink it. Let's reimagine it, let's redo it. And it seems to me that this is something we can actually put into our heads and try to practice. Pay attention, be astonished, act, doubt, repeat. And that seems to me the rhythm of what we ought to do. There's a bumper sticker that suddenly become wildly popular, but I used to see it around Chicago that I like very much, and it says, if you're not pissed off, you're not paying attention. I like it. It became wildly popular because Heather Heyer, the young woman who was killed in Charlottesville, her mother popularized that because it was apparently the tagline on her Facebook account. If you're not pissed off, you're not paying attention. But I've always wanted to add to that, at least in the last several decades, I've wanted to add to that, if you're only pissed off, you're not going to get to where you need to go. You're not going to build the society you want. And this is a tricky thing. How do we, on the one hand, allow ourselves anger, allow ourselves, you know, impatience and furiousness at unnecessary war, at the threat of nuclear war? Are you kidding? Many of us are old enough to remember when we had to dive under our desks in elementary school. Remember that? Some of you, I mean, many of you are too young, but literally at Forest Glen School in Glen Ellyn, Illinois, we would have, as a five-year-old, I was taught to get under my desk, and I remember thinking, you know, well, I didn't think it at the time, but later I was so amused to think, you know, we'll get under our desks, the nuclear war will happen, and then we'll get off and be sure to wash carefully after the nuclear explosion. You know, it's madness, but we're back in that madness, and we should be, I think, appropriately furious about it. But then again, that won't take us to where we need to be, so we have to be able to balance that with some sense of generosity, some sense of love, some sense of compassion. I'm thinking suddenly of the great revolutionary Rosa Luxemburg, who was imprisoned during World War I for refusing to support her government in that imperialist traitor's war. And there's a whole bunch of letters, Rosa Luxemburg's letters back and forth to her friends. My favorite is a friend of hers writes to her and says, Rosa, we're completely confused about what to do. We're rudderless without your leadership. We don't know where to go. What should we do? And Rosa Luxemburg writes back a very stinging letter, and it begins by saying, first of all, stop whining. which I think is great advice for the left, for progressive people, for teachers. Stop whining. It doesn't take you anywhere. But then she says, my advice to you is to be a mensch. That's M-E-N-S-C-H, for those of you who don't speak Yiddish. And you can Google it, not now, but later, Google it, mensch. But then she says, I can't define mensch for you, except to say that a mensch is someone who loves her own life enough to enjoy the sunrise and the sunset, to enjoy a bottle of wine and a good meal with friends. But a mensch is also someone who loves the world enough to put her shoulder on history's wheel when history requires it. And my advice to you is to be a mensch, to pay attention, to work out in a daily way, both personally and with your friends, how to love yourself and love the world. You need to do both, or you can't sustain yourself for a long period of time. So, demand the impossible. I took that phrase from, it comes from many places. James Baldwin said it, many people have said it, but where I remember it from is in 1968. It was all over the walls of Paris. And the phrase was, be realistic, demand the impossible. And what I like the dialectic of that, and I like the idea that demanding the possible just gets us stuck in a framework that we've already been given. And we need to get beyond that framework. So we need to say things more dramatically, more radically, to unleash our radical imaginations. Because imagination is also a necessary part of building a struggle for social justice. If you just demand the possible, then you just make incremental changes where they are. Think about, I'm thinking about for a moment, the moments when we've actually made serious change in this country, and it's always come from fire from below, and it's always come from unreasonable people making unreasonable demands. And, it's never come because a change of heart of a leader. It's never come because somebody suddenly woke up and said, oh, I get it. Think back, three presidents. Think of Lyndon Johnson, who passed the most far-reaching civil rights legislation since Reconstruction. But he didn't just have a brainstorm and say, this is a good idea. He actually was responding to the Black Freedom Movement, which was absolutely shaking the country to its foundations. And he was an effective politician, and he did what he did. But it came because of fire from below. Think about Franklin Roosevelt, passed the most far-reaching social and labor legislation, but he was a patrician from the Hudson Valley. What made him do that? Well, we could argue Eleanor Roosevelt made him do it, but I think it's more appropriate to say it was fire from below. It was the labor movement itself. And then think back to Abraham Lincoln, never a member of an abolitionist party. And I'll bet you nobody in here has read his first inaugural address. Maybe some of you are historians and have read it. The first inaugural address is a disaster. That's where he genuflects in front of the slave owners and says, oh, I won't bother your enterprise. Everything's going to be good. Let's stay united. The second inaugural address is the one you read in your history books because it could have been written by Frederick Douglass. That's the one where he says, for every drop of blood brought on by the whip, we will answer with a drop of blood from the sword. My God, Abraham Lincoln, what the hell happened? Fire from below is what happened. The Civil War is what happened. And so our job, it seems to me, those of us who believe that fundamental change is necessary, is to unleash our imaginations, to think beyond what's given to us, to go beyond the debate about body cameras as a reform, to go beyond the debate about better educational programs in prisons, to go on beyond the debate about Obamacare versus predatory capitalism. I mean, we can go beyond that debate and we can say what we really want is universal health care. What we really want is a conversation about what policing would look like in a free and democratic society as opposed to an occupying army. Those are the kinds of conversations we want to have. But it requires us, it seems to me, to unleash our imaginations. I'm remembering Emily Dickinson, one of my favorite American poets, and her comment that imagination lights the slow fuse of possibility. I kind of love that. Imagination lights the slow fuse of possibility. And then I think of the great Chicago poet, Gwendolyn Brooks, who said, she wrote a poem at the dedication of the Picasso. Do you know the Picasso in downtown Chicago? Is a landmark? Is it a bird? Is it a woman? Nobody knows. Brooks wrote a dedication to Picasso, and it begins, Does man love art? ? And her response, man visits art but cringes. Art hurts. Art urges voyages. And the voyages that art urges are voyages of the imagination, where we can imagine a world that could be or should be, but is not yet. And that's what I think, I set out to do, was to say, what do we really want? One other note on that is that I take up in the book 8 issues, war, policing, prisons, education, healthcare, taxing. But you know, the interesting thing is I've been constructed for a long time in certain quarters as a far left radical, and I suppose I am. But the odd thing is I've never felt that I was out of the mainstream when it came to the main issues I care about. I've never felt that I was some kind of marginal nutcase living in a barricaded room. I've always felt this is what most Americans feel. And if I can't convince people, then it's on me, it's my problem. I have to be a better organizer, I have to be a better thinker, I have to be a better communicator, I have to knock on more doors. But take the question of war and peace. Most Americans want to believe that we're a peaceful people. The fact that we're not a peaceful people, the fact that we are the new Sparta, comes as a shock every time. Niger is the current shock. We're actually over there meddling in the affairs over there. That's outrageous. But those are the kind of things, it seems to me, we have to kind of challenge ourselves about. So I think we're in a moment, we're in a treacherous moment, and it's a moment I think of as a moment of movement or movement making. Because as I said, I think social movements are what change things. I don't think we need to spend all of our energy thinking about the next election cycle. In fact, in some ways, I think it's a diversion. What we really need is a social movement that can make the next election cycle inevitable. And that's more important, and that's where folks like us, ordinary folks, can actually make a difference. We can actually make a difference if we speak up and expand the public space in our workplaces, in our schools and classrooms, in our neighborhoods. Bernadine and I went to Washington, D.C. This is so sad. We were planning to go to the inauguration of Hillary Clinton, and so sad. And we were going to go as protesters. We had, with a group of people all over the country, we were going to have a peace ball the night before the inauguration. And we did indeed have a peace ball at the African American Museum of Culture and History. If you haven't seen that, you must make a plan to go see it. It's incredible. But we had a peace ball the night before the inauguration. Our plan was, and everything would have been normal, Hillary in the White House, us over here with our peace signs, normal behavior. Suddenly Donald Trump is the president and nothing is normal anymore. This is the scholar Jack Halberstam calls the queer art of failure. We had failed and the world was no longer the same. But there we were at the peace ball, and we were, it was a great gathering of progressive people, and it was a great, terrifying and at the same time exhilarating evening. The next day we went to the inauguration, and the reason we went is because our congressman on the south side of Chicago had tickets to the inauguration, and he couldn't give them away. Nobody on the south side of Chicago wanted to go. So we took 12 of them and gave most of them to Code Pink, and then Bernadine and I went in, and we took in a sign, a big banner, that said, say no to racism, say no to Islamophobia. And we were 2 of the 1.5 million people that Donald Trump thought he saw that were actually there. And it was magnificent because we spent 4 hours talking to strangers. And this, I recommend it to you. I recommend to you that you talk to strangers, that you just don't talk to people who are in your club, who are in your mindset, who all read The New Yorker or listen to NPR. Talk to somebody else and you learn a lot. You learn, a lot of people went by this sign Bernadine was holding and they said, I agree with that. I don't agree with you, but I agree with that. So yeah, we were in a conversation, it was great. The next day we went to the Women's March, and I'm sure some of you went to that here or somewhere. It was incredible, and I've never seen anything like it. That kind of spontaneous, uprising, spontaneous sign making, all kinds of groups and collectives. My sister, who's 2 years older than me, came. She's never been to a demonstration in her life, and she's, you know, 77 years old. Wow, amazing. It was incredible for her. So it was a kind of amazing thing, and I think those of you who witnessed it or participated in it know what I mean. My favorite slogan was a group of early childhood, I'm an old early childhood teacher, a group of early childhood educators were marching, and their chant was, you know, the Dr. Seuss Green Eggs and Ham, you know, the rhythm of Green Eggs and Ham. So it was, don't put your hand down my shirt, don't put your hand up my skirt, don't put your hand on my rump, I do not like you, Donald Trump. I've been repeating it ever since. But we decided there, and many people decided then, that we have to figure out ways to, as the concept of the public is being eclipsed, as the public is disappearing, we need to expand the space for public conversation. And people have done remarkable things. One of the things Bernadine did that kind of blew my mind is she leafleted our neighborhood, and we had 40 people over for brunch on a Saturday shortly after the inauguration. And we didn't do much, we just went around and said what each of us was involved in. These are people we don't know. I mean, we see them every day for 30 years, but we know their dogs better than we know them. And it was kind of neat to have a conversation where people talked about what they were doing in their church or their synagogue. People talked about issues they were concerned about, and we kept meeting. That's a simple example of expanding the public space, of looking toward a possible future. But I think the world that we're living in now, the moment we're living in, is a moment that demands movement building. And movement building involves two steps every time that we all ought to be taking. One is we have to dive into the issues we care about, whatever issue you care about, and reframe the issue, somehow rethink it so that we're not simply doing what's taken for granted. So if you care about women's rights or queer rights or international human rights or immigration or Black Lives Matter, whatever you're involved in, keep turning the issue and making sure that it says what you believe it ought to say. Then you need to connect the issue to every other issue. So war connects to warming. Black Lives Matter connects to decent education and the demilitarizing of the police. It connects to both. So it's both reframing and connecting the issues, and that's what will lead, I think, ultimately to a mighty, unstoppable, you know, social movement. Because the moment we live in, if I could, I'll give you one quick example, and then I really do want to have some conversation, because it was called the community conversation. But, you know, I look at something like the Paris Climate Accord. The Paris Climate Accord is the most far-reaching international agreement ever reached on climate. It's unbelievable victory for the international community to come to that. And simultaneously, if every benchmark were met in the Paris Climate Agreement, we would still be screwed in 20 years. That's the contradiction. So another way of saying it more generally is that the demands, the needs that we must meet are absolutely in contradiction with what's politically possible. So how do you change that equation? How do you make the impossible possible? And that's where it comes the question of organizing, of talking to strangers, of learning to get out of your comfort zone and have a conversation. And yes, get beat down and get depressed and then keep trying. I mean, one of the great things about being involved in a movement for justice is that it can be wearing, but it also can give you enormous energy to be with other people, making sacrifices, trying, finding fellowship in the attempt. One quick example, and I don't think, incidentally, struggling for social justice always is based on an equation of victory. It's not always based on an equation of winning. It's sometimes based on an equation of wanting to make your identity on the basis of what you stand up for and what you stand up against. So 30 years ago, was it 30 years ago? Close to 30 years ago, the state of Illinois reinstated the death penalty. And in their wisdom, they decided to murder John Wayne Gacy, who was the poster. Do you know who that is, John Wayne Gacy? A mass murderer, he killed young gay people on the north side of Chicago, buried him in his backyard. A real, real terrible person. But as the execution date drew nearer, the kind of glee with which the media was meeting this moment drove Bernadine and me nuts. So we drew straws, and we had three little kids at the time, and I won. So I got to drive down to Statesville to stand outside the prison with my little thou shalt not kill sign, and she put the kids to bed. I got down there at about 10:30 at night, and I was met with a beer party, a beer and rock and roll party, 2,000 young people celebrating the murder of the monster, right? And I was so horrified, I was so taken aback, but I put my little sign under my shirt because I didn't want to get killed. And I went to the front of the prison, and there I found 9 elderly nuns, 2 lawyers, and me. And we stood there with our little candles, objecting to the killing of John Wayne Gacy. So I went home that night feeling marginal. I often feel marginal in those kind of situations, but I felt particularly marginal that night. 2 years later, one of the lawyers standing next to me won the first wrongful conviction suit. 2 years late after that, our Republican, mildly corrupt governor who went from the governorship to prison, but if you know Illinois, that's the career path, that's what everybody does. But George Bryan, my favorite Illinois governor, commuted the death sentences and got people off death row, closed death row. And Illinois became a leader in the country against the death penalty. No one could have predicted it when we went down there that night. I wasn't a part of that movement. But that's just, you know, to me, you have to take certain stands because it affirms your humanity. And you don't know, because history has surprised us before, and history will surprise us again, and we could be the agents of that surprise if we're willing. Thank you, sir.
All right. Yeah. Yeah.
So who'd like to ask a question?
Or make a statement.
Or make a statement. Yes.
Thanks. My question is, with regard to the current moment, what do you think is the most relevant historical analog, specifically as an example of successful multiracial organizing? I think sort of the holy grail now is how do you bring folks together that are being good at part.
Are you going to repeat the question?
You can repeat it.
Yeah, so the question is, what, in regards to our current moment, is the best historical analog about multiracial organizing to make change?
You know, I'm not sure I have a great historical analog. I can point to the struggle in South Africa, certainly the fight against apartheid, the labor movement in the 30s in some ways, the abolitionist movement in other ways. But I'm not sure I have a great historical analog. But I think what you're pointing to is absolutely essential. That is that we find ways to take the movements that are on the ground. And no one should think that we're starting from zero. If you look, I mean, I feel very fortunate to live in Chicago. I know a lot of people think, really? Yes, I really do. And I feel sorry for folks who don't live in Chicago. But that's just me. But I say I'm fortunate for a couple reasons. One is because people say, well, how do we build a movement against Trump, or how do we build a progressive movement? We are witnessing right now in Chicago and elsewhere the latest iteration of the centuries-old struggle for black freedom. And it's an exciting moment for Black Youth Project 100, for Black Lives Matter, for the movement for all black lives. This is an incredible moment. And it's not so distant. You can find it. It's within reach. So find it and be a part of it. People say, you know, a lot of people ask, you know, how do I be an ally to that movement? And I think ally is kind of the wrong word, because an ally implies I'll help lift you up. It has a certain condescension built into it. I want to say, I guess first I would say, if you want to be a part of the movement that's already happening, the first requirement is that you listen, that you listen hard, that you don't think you know everything, but you go and listen to the young people. So I get asked in Chicago, a reporter asked me the other day, are you mentoring the Black Lives Matter kids? I'm like, dude, they're mentoring me. You know, I'm learning from them, and that's always the way it is. When we were kids in the civil rights movement, you know, we were teaching the old people. It wasn't the other way around. So I'm happy to be a follower and a listener. But the other thing is, the reason I think ally is not quite the right word is because what we want to be is in solidarity with, not in service to. So actually, I think many of you who are men in this room, know that you would have a better life if women were equal, if women's liberation were a fact on the ground, men's lives would be better. James Baldwin was the first person who made this point that I was aware of, that I understood, when he said, for white people to be free, black people have to be free, and it will free you up from the agony and the precariousness of being white. What a great idea, you know, that I don't want to live in a white supremacist society. I don't want to live in a male supremacist society. And because I don't want to, I want to be a fellow revolutionary with the Black Lives Matter kids. I don't want to be an ally who's helping them. You know, I don't want to just make bail for them. I want to be with them. So that's one thing. But the second thing about being in Chicago is this is where the immigrant rights movement started. You remember 10 years ago when the marches happened and suddenly in the pages of the New York Times, people were being interviewed who said, you know, my name is Juan Gonzalez and I own a cleaning business and I've been here illegally for 25 years. His name is in the New York Times. I mean, people were suddenly coming out, 12 million people. So that great march that happened 10 years ago, which we were on, you know, it started in the west side of Chicago, it marched down Randolph Street, and then it made a detour so that it could go by the Haymarket statue. You know what the Haymarket, remember what the Haymarket is? That's where the eight-hour day was fought for and won in 1886. And the Haymarket was, the Haymarket so-called riot, the police riot at Haymarket, was actually immigrant workers fighting for the eight-hour day, fighting for the rights of workers. So the Immigrant Rights March decided they had to take a little detour to pay homage to something that had happened 100-some years ago. So I think that the immigrant, the undocumented and unafraid in Chicago, Black Youth Project 100, the Fight for 15, all of these movements are already happening. Then the question is, how do we get together? And again, on Sunday I'm going to the next meeting of a group they're called the 3 R's, Resist, Reimagine, and Rebuild. And this is an attempt of 36 organizations to hammer out a common program, a common view of what we're fighting for, so that the Black Lives Matter folks have in their program a plank about peace, and so that the peace folks have in their work an understanding of the necessity of seeing the world through the lens of the bloody heritage of Black oppression, and so on. It's so exciting to be at a meeting with 36 organizations trying to hammer out what we really believe. You can do that in Seattle. You have all the tools to do it, and a place like this could be a center where it could be done. So those are the kind of things. I'm not helping you with the historical analog, and maybe somebody else can help us with that, but I think that's how I think of it. I think that we need to think about how to build unity in a way that understands the particularity of each movement as it moves forward. You could follow up if you want, but yeah.
I wonder if you could speak to this particular complexity in the struggle, African American struggle. So, beginning with slavery, African slaves were prohibited from learning how to read, and throughout the struggle, Black communities have been disenfranchised from access to education in many ways. And that education isn't just about book learning, but it's also about access to information. And so now you have a scenario where a lot of the peaceful components of that disenfranchisement have been somewhat solved. I'll give you some examples. If you're poor enough, community college is free. And then if you do well, you can transfer from there to USC or Yale or Harvard or wherever you want to go. If you do well there, you can go on and get a PhD and they'll pay you to do it. And so the access to education situation is sort of solved. If you're in California and your kid goes to an underperforming school, by state law, you can take them out of the underperforming school and put them into any school in the district, which means you can go from Lock High or something like that in South Central to Hollywood High, which performs really well. If you know about NACA, you can get a zero down loan at better than market rate interest and buy a home. You don't have to be a first-time buyer to do that. So a lot of points are sort of solved in some ways, but there seems to be a lack of access. Most of the things that I just mentioned, most people don't know about. And so while we're fighting for people who are being strangled to death for selling cigarettes or shot in the back and left bleeding on the ground, there's this lack of knowledge or lack of access to the information seems to be almost like the secret weapon. Because you could have reparations for slaves in the form of a check, and they'll say, all you have to do is go to this website and sign up, and no one would even know it's there. They would never sign up. And so, you know, if you could just kind of speak to the idea of not just how we deal with the physical violence and some of the more visible issues, but some of those kind of background lack of access issues and things like that that sort of keep black and brown people from accessing the things that are actually there.
Yeah, I mean, first, that your premise that education is critical, I couldn't agree with more. I am a teacher, I'm an educator, and frankly, I think the two kind of things I pursued in my adult life, starting when I was about 18, have been community organizing and teaching, and frankly, I think they're the same thing. I think a good community organizer knocks on the door and assumes that there's an intelligent, three-dimensional person on the other side. A good teacher, the same thing. We look out in our classrooms and we assume an intelligence that it's our job to unlock and to connect to. It's not, we don't assume just a room full of deficits. So I think that education is absolutely key, and education is not just something that takes place in schools. It's something that, it's funny, I became a teacher. I was arrested in 1965 in a draft board destroying draft files, and I went to jail. And I met a teacher in the jail. We were in the same struggle. And I went out of jail into my first teaching job. So for me, it's not true for everybody who's a teacher, but for me, the question of social justice and the question of education have been linked from the beginning. So I don't see any difference. I think living and learning are the same thing. I think democracy and education are the same thing. And so I agree with you on that. I think the question of access is absolutely central, and I don't think the question of access has been solved, and you kind of said that glancingly at one point, but I don't think it's been solved at all, and it's partly lack of information, but it's partly also people's life circumstances. You know, people talk about poor people floating along on a cloud of real ignorance. I mean, we drive through the city and we see poor people, but when was the last time you had a poor person into your house for dinner? When was the last time a homeless person came to your house for dinner, or you went to the home of a homeless person? That doesn't make any sense. But you know what I mean. What's the intimate knowledge we have of the lives of others? And I say that partly because it's very hard to be poor. It takes a lot of energy to get through the day, and people don't really understand that or recognize that. But I want to talk about the Chicago Public Schools for a moment, which are a catastrophe. And I have two granddaughters, 13 and 10, and they attended Chicago Public Schools until last year. 4 years ago, they got rid of the art teacher, austerity. You know, we're broke. Broke on purpose is what we say in response, but okay, we're broke. Can't have the art teacher. 3 years ago, they got rid of the music teacher. It is a neat little nice neighborhood school. 2 years ago, they closed the library. There's no counselor, there's no nurse, there's no librarian, there's no music teacher, there's no art teacher. And last year they were told they had to bring their own toilet paper to school. In the richest country, in one of the richest cities in that country, my granddaughters are asked to bring their own toilet paper. The message is loud and clear. The message is, if you can get out, get out. Well, my kids could get out, so they got out. You can move to the suburbs, you can go to private school, you can go to Catholic school, whatever you want to do. But the message is, we do not respect you. We do not respect your humanity, and we're pushing you away. So if you are in a neighborhood and you go to a Chicago public school and your parents or your single parent or whatever doesn't have the wherewithal to find alternatives, you're stuck in an apartheid system of education. And Chicago is an apartheid system of education. And the message is, we don't care about you. That's a very serious message. And I'll tell you why I get pissed off if I'm not paying attention. I'm pissed off because Arne Duncan, who I used to know quite well, I haven't known him for a while, but Arne Duncan, you may know, was the Secretary of Education for 8 years. Before that, he was the superintendent, or since it's a business now, we call him the CEO of the Chicago Public Schools for 4 years. For 12 years, he's been telling us and being the architect of the schools we need. Drill and kill, test till you bleed, you know, this is Arne Duncan, right? Privatize, all these things, and I could go into it in much greater detail. But here's the important point. Arne Duncan comes back to Chicago after 8 years in Washington. He can't find a single public school to send his kids to. So he sends his kids to the University of Chicago Lab School, where the mayor's kids go, where Mayor Daley's kids go, where Barack Obama's kids went, where Arne Duncan himself went for 12 years. How is that possible? And so my response to that is to say, whatever the most privileged and wisest parents have for their children should be the baseline that we as a community in a democracy want for all of our children. So what do they find at the lab school? A class size capped at 15, a curriculum based in part in the interest of the children, a unionized teacher corps. Nobody beats the shit out of the University of Chicago teacher, lab school teachers union. It's a union. And they go on strike sometimes. They go on strike around working conditions. Why do they do that? Because good working conditions are good teaching conditions. Good teaching conditions are good learning conditions. That's what they argue. Well, if it's good enough for Arnie's kids, why is it good enough for your kids or my kids? And that, it seems to me, is something that we ought to be organizing around, and we are organizing around in Chicago. We want a full arts program. We want fine arts, we want drama, we want music, just like they have at the lab school. We don't want any more than what Arne has, we want exactly what he has. And it seems to me that's the kind of thing we ought to fight for. One last word on education. So you can Google Black Youth Project 100 or Black Lives Matter or the Movement for Black Lives and get their programs. And they're very comprehensive. And education is a central part of the program. So in Chicago, where the mayor, in his wisdom, closed 50 schools. Meanwhile, he sends his kids, as I said, to the lab school. Closed 50 schools in black neighborhoods. They were underutilized. His kids go to a school where the class size is capped at 15. Are they underutilized? Meanwhile, the second grade right down the road has 40 kids in a second grade class. This is apartheid education. We should be absolutely outraged by it. But you should look up BYP 100 or any of these groups and see what their education platform is. But from my experience, going back to kind of the historical analog, I have one historical analog around education, which is, in my experience, the most exciting educational development that I was blessed to be a part of was the Freedom School movement in the South, the Mississippi Freedom School, and you can Google that too, 1964 Mississippi Freedom School curriculum. This is a curriculum that was developed at a point, I know for those of you who are young, the civil rights movement is a story about, continual uplift. It didn't happen like that at all. It was always like this. And 1962, 63, 64, the movement was at a loss. And a young man named Charlie Cobb, who was part of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, wrote a proposal. It wasn't a proposal to the MacArthur Foundation or the Department of Education. It was a proposal to his pals, to his comrades, to his colleagues. And it was a proposal that was just a mimeograph sheet. And if you don't know what a mimeograph sheet is, you can Google that too. But it was just a copy that he had made. And what it said was, the children of Mississippi have been denied many things. Decent facilities, forward-looking curriculum, fully trained teachers. But the fundamental injury is that the black children of Mississippi have been denied the right to think for themselves about the circumstances of their lives and how they might be otherwise. That's the key phrase in Charlie's proposal. They've been denied the right to think for themselves about the circumstances of their lives and how they might be otherwise. Sounds pretty cool, but kind of innocuous until you think about Mississippi, feudal Mississippi in 1963. Three of the martyrs of Mississippi, Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney, were Freedom School teachers, and they were investigating the arson bombing of Freedom School when they were picked up by the police and lynched. So it was a revolutionary statement then, and it's a revolutionary statement now. The people of the West Side of Chicago, the children of the West Side of Chicago have been denied many things, but the basic problem is they've been denied the right to say, this is the circumstances of my life, this is how it ought to change. That's revolutionary. The Freedom School curriculum goes on, it's 24 pages of questions, and it begins, why are you and I in the freedom movement? What do we hope to accomplish? What does the majority culture have that we want? What do we have that we want to maintain? That is a very powerful way of getting people to think about the circumstances of their lives. It's not saying, here's a curriculum, this is the shit you want to learn in order to be a functioning person. It's saying, take control of yourself, and notice the one thing that the ruling powers never want you to notice. You have agency. You have agency. You can do things. And you know, sometimes I think the powerful always think that they are people with agency, history, culture, you know, self-reflection, but the rest of us can be written off by our statistical profiles, age, name, you know, zip code, level of education. That's how we're talked about, but they talk about themselves as people of agency. We have to flip that and say, we are people of agency, and the students we educate, the key lesson is you have agency. In fact, sometimes I think, as soon as I stand up in front of my class and say, okay, let's get started, I already lost. I already messed up, because actually what I want to say to them is, I can't teach you anything, but you can seize an education, and I'm happy to go along with you, I'm happy to be in dialogue with you, but if you think you're going to sit there passively, and I'm going to educate you, and in the kind of weird individualistic society we've become, students will literally say to professors, I paid for this lecture, give it to me, you know? I mean, what? You know, yeah, I mean, education, and this is Arne Duncan. Part of the reason Arne Duncan can't be a good opposition to Betsy DeVos, or put it more broadly, the Democrats can't lead the opposition to the Republicans, because for three or four decades, they've been on the same path. Arne Duncan also acted as if education is a product to be sold at the marketplace. Now, Betsy DeVos is a monster, don't be mistaken, but Arne Duncan paved the way. He said education is a product, not a human right. I say education is a human right, and it's a process, and it's lifelong and endless. I will not concede that it's like a refrigerator or a bar of soap that you buy at the marketplace. It's not. It's different in quality and kind. So if I'm thinking about what kind of education I want to put forward now, I want to say, let's look to the 1964 Freedom School curriculum as an example of a curriculum of questioning, a curriculum of agency. I'll give you one last example. I know I'm going on, but as my son said, you get paid by the word. Okay, but one last example. Anything can be turned into a Freedom School curriculum. So you know who Governor Huckabee was? You know Sarah Huckabee's father? He was the governor of Arkansas, and he weighed he was an enormously large guy. I think he weighed 370 pounds or something. And he lost a ton of weight when he decided to run for president. And he became a kind of poster child for dramatic weight loss and kind of a spokesman against childhood obesity, to his credit. I mean, that's a good thing. But you may not know this, that in Arkansas, when Huckabee was governor, they put in every kid's report card your body mass index. Imagine going home and having an A in English, a B in history, a C in mathematics, and you're fat. I mean, what do you do with that? I mean, how do you respond to that? So I had a friend who was teaching in Arkansas High School, and he decided to do a Freedom School curriculum turn on that mandate. And what he did is he said, let's ask a series of questions. What's the history of these kinds of mandates being put into, you know, high schools in terms of changing behavior? How are we doing with the drug awareness or the pregnancy awareness curriculum? So that's one question. What's the state of physical education in Arkansas schools? What's the state of our sports programs? What's the state of around our high schools in Little Rock, for example? Are there food deserts? Are there opportunities to get real good food and fresh food and so on? So they did the exact same thing. They just began to interrogate the reality. That's the kind of education kids need, an education that unlocks their curiosity and pursues their agency.
That's it for this podcast version of Speakers Forum. You can hear the full version on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. This event featuring Bill Ayers, hosted by Northeastern University Seattle, took place at Impact Hub Seattle in Pioneer Square on November 1st. Thank you for listening. Tune in again soon.